Welcome to The Contrarians, where we are right and you are wrong. I'm Julio.
And I'm Alex. Here on the show, we rage against the Rotten Tomatoes machine. For the first half of each episode, Contrarians Corner, we trash the fresh red tomatoes and praise the rotten green splotches, making our case any way we can.
The aptly titled Real Talk serves as the second half of each episode. This is where we discuss our true feelings on the movie we're covering. For more information on our podcast and to browse past episodes, you can head over to our website, wearethecontrarians.com.
From there, you can also access our Patreon and merchandise, because capitalism.
If you enjoy our attempts at comedic film discussions, we encourage you to subscribe and leave us a review on whatever podcatcher you use.
If you'd like to reach out to us directly, that's what social media is for. You can find us on most platforms as @ContrarianPrime.
You can also see what we look like if you go to youtube.com/@ContrarianPrime, and you can contact us by email at wearethecontrarians@gmail.com.
I think that covers it.
Then it's time for the podcast. And we are recording for Contrarians Corner for Things to Do in Denver When You Are Dead. One of the longest titles we've ever covered, I think, Alex.
Hello, and welcome to The Contrarians, where we're right and you are wrong. My name is Alex, joined as always by my co-host, my Andy Garcia, in this case, Julio Oliveira.
Why do I have to be Andy Garcia? I mean, I guess because of the accent, but I don't want the weight of the world on my shoulders.
I mean, you can be William Forsythe with a bunch of badass tattoos.
The surprisingly likable William Forsythe.
I'm obviously old, and I'm Christopher Lloyd in this movie, working as a projectionist at a porno theater. I mean, if a few things didn't go right in the past few years for me, don't you think? Well, honestly, I don't even think there's porn theaters that use 35 millimeter anymore. So
they are in Denver, apparently. How about we are the Walken's goons? You know, they seem to have a good working relationship.
Yeah. One of which, of course, being Don Stark, Bob Pinciotti, who is expanding his vocabulary. He uses the word specious, and Andy Garcia is like, what the fuck? But yes, again, here today, Things to Do in Denver When You Are Dead. I'm trying to think of things that rival that. How to Make Friends and Alienate People. Seeking a Friend for the End of the... Is it the End of the World or the End of the Universe?
End of the World.
It's actually a decent movie.
Movie we screened together.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure if I thought hard enough, I could come up with other ones. But none of those, to my knowledge, at least, tanked as badly as having an $8 million budget and a box office return of $500,000.
Ooh, really?
Yeah. Both critically and financially, this was not successful. 37% on Rotten Tomatoes as of this recording. One of those nasty green splotches. Roger Ebert, unless you had him for your quotes, did you?
For Real Talk, not for Contrarians okay. Corner.
Then I won't ape that bit quite yet. he weighed in his thoughts on it, which I think are the thoughts that a lot of the conversation Real Talk will center around. So that's a good one to pull. Gary Fleeter, directed, written by Scott Rosenberg, starring a who's who. It really does have a crazy cast. And Scott Rosenberg, of course, as we mentioned in the teaser for this, returning to Contrarians lore from both Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, and of course, Beautiful Girls.
This is his debut on the main feed.
It was his debut as a screenwriter as well.
How appropriate. Gary Fleeter, on the other hand, he's already been here before. Homefront, is that the name of it?
Yes, the 2013 action flick starring all-American Jason Statham and evil drug peddler James Franco, which Hulu and I were both fans of. And of course, Winona Ryder, the entire reason we did it was yep. Winona Ryder's in it. So
how could he not find a place for Andy Garcia in Homefront?
Maybe that was part of the deal, because remember Stallone wrote that movie? He's like, you can only have my script as long as you don't get that fucker Andy Garcia in here. A patron pick from our good friend Filmbusters Ben. And one hell of an interesting movie. One that I was unaware of until it was selected for us to cover, Julio, and I kind of have begun to understand why in doing my research for this. This came and went and has been kind of hidden by time. I assume this was your first viewing as well?
It is, but not for lack of trying. There was a time, I guess, when it came out where I am surprised to find out that it was just so unpopular and that it was so short-lived, I guess, when it came to the zeitgeist, because in my mind, this was kind of like a big movie from the 90s that I had missed. Like, I remember the poster and I remember mostly the DVD, not the DVD, the VHS cover. Like, I remember seeing it whenever we went to rent movies, probably a Blockbuster, and always thinking, okay, I'll get to it. I'll get to it. And, you know, it was Andy Garcia's face with his hands. Just, he looked like he was deep in thought, and the title was kind of, I'm like, what does that mean? Is he dead? Is he a ghost? So I was always curious about it. At the time, I didn't know anything about Scott Rosenberg. I didn't know anything about Gary Fletcher. To be honest, I didn't know anything about Gary Fletcher until a couple of years ago when we did Homefront. But it just, I never got to it. And, you know how it goes. Sometimes just you miss that window with a movie and it's, then you have 50 other movies that you want to watch before that one. And I guess I am just not the Andy Garcia fan that I think Ben is. Otherwise, I would have hunted this down much, much sooner.
I can see Ben rallying around just a guy who I don't think panned out the way a lot of people envisioned. Godfather 3 was his like debut, right?
At least as far as the big splash. He might have had other credits beforehand, but that's something. He got an Oscar nomination, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. He was in The Untouchables, but The Godfather 3, that was like the big attempt at making him like a big star.
And then he went on and made that movie with Michael Keaton that we covered also on Patreon, also requested by Ben.
Dangerous, not, what was that movie called? Desperate Measures.
Yes.
That movie fucking ruled.
I called it out on the previous episode, and I don't want it to not be called out on this episode. He was also in Passengers. He shows up for like one frame.
You say this. That's pretty close to one of those movies that I just remember absolutely nothing about. I remember Michael Sheen is the robotic bartender. That's all I remember.
Yes.
That's the same movie, right?
Yes.
Okay.
he just shows up at the end. Andy Garcia, he shows up as a captain.
Oh, I'm remembering this now. It's coming to my brain. All right. Well, to talk of a better movie here, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. That is like a Brandon Curtis title. I could see him writing a screenplay with something like that.
You got too many movements, you ask me. The only good movement's a fucking bowel movement.
So, Julio, 37% Rotten Tomatoes, and as we mentioned, at box office, B-O-M-B. But what quotes did you pull? Where's this negativity coming from? And how much of it revolves around Quentin Tarantino and Pulp Fiction?
Oh, dude. Almost 99% of the quotes. To be fair, there's a lot of quotes that are ghost quotes. You know, they have the green splotch, but there's nothing there. So either the link is dead, the critic retired, or they just didn't care to update, the Rotten Tomatoes version. Whatever the case, there's a few, and there's not that many reviews to begin with. So I think maybe, guys, if we all got together, got Rotten Tomatoes certified and submitted new reviews for this movie, we might get it to move up to like 50% at least. We have a few listeners, a couple of patrons that are Rotten Tomatoes critics. So Katie, OT, get to it. You can maybe
pump
this up. Eddie Straight, yeah. But as it is, I was able to grab 3 rotten quotes. Then Ebert's rotten quote we're saving for real talk because I think it fits better there, along with Ben's own comments about the movie. We'll find those out in real talk. But let's start here with Scott Weinberg from efilmcritic.com, who says, "More tough guy stuff inspired by Tarantino." Already. We just did Kill Bill 1 and 2, Alex.
We did.
I don't see the common ground between the Kill Bills and Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Well, we were certainly living in the wake of Pulp Fiction at this point in time and Wes Craven's New Nightmare, of course.
So did Tarantino prove us wrong? Is that what happened? It's like, oh, you think I'm going to make a movie like Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead? No, I'm going to turn left.
I wonder if he's seen this, because you know how he is. He's pretty wacky with his movie taste. He probably would like this.
Would he be flattered or would he be offended? by the comparisons.
They're not comparisons. They're damnations, pretty much. Condemnations. Yeah. I don't know. What is it? Imitation's the sincerest form of flattery?
Yeah, I guess.
Dude, hundreds and hundreds of people have tried to make Pulp Fiction since 1994, and I've never heard Tarantino be like, fuck y'all. So.
But also, you haven't heard him go, like, good job, guys.
Yeah, because he would still say, I can do it better, Jan.
Give me a Christopher Lloyd as Bill in Kill Bill. Then.
God, yes.
All right. Well, we're not done with Tarantino comments. Emmanuel Levy from EmmanuelLevy.com says, "Their Tarantino effect at its worst. Yet another movie about a relentlessly violent gang reportedly based on a bet the director made with Tarantino." What is this? What is this lore? Alex, do you know what he's talking about?
I don't. That's not something I've come across yet.
So Gary Fletcher, Quentin Tarantino, drinking late at night, and Fletcher goes, I bet you I can do it better. Is that just what happened? And Tarantino said, okay, but Andy Garcia has to be the lead.
Yeah, I don't know. That's wild.
Well, QT, if you're still listening after the Kill Bill episodes, let us know. Reach out. Set the story straight. Now, we're going to close with Jonathan Rosenbaum from the Chicago Reader, who says, alas, most of the surprise and the wit to be found here ends with the title. That is harsher than all the Tarantino comparisons.
Well, it's named after a Warren Zevon song.
Is that true?
Yes.
I don't know if you're like making a joke. There's a song called Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Yeah. And I mean, Warren Zevon was an eccentric songwriter, a very talented one as well. But the film title is taken from a Warren Zevon song of the same name from his 1991 release, Mr. Bad Example. Zevon was not happy with the movie being named after his song, and Miramax had to rectify it by paying him. And the song appears in the end credits.
I mean, that is such a unique title. I guess there's no way they could say it's a coincidence. It's not about the song. Like, if you made a movie called November Rain, do you think that Axl Rose would come after you?
Yes.
Even if you made a movie called December Rain.
Yes. That's the whole story about the wrestler that made that so fucking, like, what? Was he let them use Sweet Child of Mine for the Rams last match gratis. And that's so unlike Axl Rose. That's why it was so surprising. So yes, do not name your movie November Rain. He will come after you and take you down to the jungle.
All right. Well, those are the quotes, Alex. Before we go into Contreras Corner, I'm curious, how did you watch this bad boy? Do you have Showtime?
The Spectrum app. My parents have Spectrum Cable and I have their login. And through that, they have Showtime on demand.
Nice.
Yeah, it took a while to find it because that app is shit and not organized well. And like just under the Showtime tab, there's like 500 movies. So I was like, I searched Denver, no returns. Then I searched Things and I had to still like sift through a bunch of shit. But yeah, the Spectrum app, when you actually do fire up something, the streaming quality is very consistent and very good. That's how I've been watching this most recent season of Dark Side of the Ring as well. So you have Paramount Plus. How'd you watch it?
I do have Paramount Plus, but I have the old plan before they added Showtime. And so I could switch to the new plan that has Showtime, but it would increase my monthly fee by like $2. And I'm not going to do that. So instead, I just figured I would, at first I was just going to rent Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, but then I saw it was only $3 more to buy it. So now I own Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
You don't own it. You have a copy that you can stream, but you don't own it.
I own the right to stream it
for
as
now,
long as it is on Amazon Prime.
I haven't even consulted the physical media release of this. I'll have to do so.
By the end of this episode, I might be convinced to buy it. I don't know. We'll see what our conversation yields as far as the advantages and disadvantages of owning this movie.
All right.
Let's go. Let's do it, Alex. Let's go to Denver.
Jimmy the Saint from Flatbush. Went to seminary school, but lost the calling. But in his day, the bitch is bastard.
Trying to go straight, ex-gangster Jimmy the Saint Tosnia runs Afterlife Advice in Denver, where dying people videotape messages for their loved ones. This immediately ages this movie, Julio, in the sense of old people have phones now and can just do it that way. They don't need, I don't think they ever needed Andy Garcia and Stanford from Sex and the City to help them do this, but that's what this movie proffers.
Alex, you clearly don't work with older people on a regular basis.
Fair.
I do. And I can tell you, and this is not me being ageist or whatever. I think eventually it's going to happen to me. It's going to happen to you. There comes a point where technology starts lapping you and you need people like Andy Garcia to help you record messages for your descendants. So I bought it. I just don't think that he had the best, the idea is good. The execution was lacking. And the part where he borrowed money from the mob was terrible. He was destined to fail. But as a concept, I think it's an interesting idea, right? I don't think there's a company that's doing that, because it's not so much the technology. The technology is part of it, but I also think the criteria, right? Like, not everybody has the charisma and the ease in front of a camera to just suddenly record something that's going to be interesting for somebody that watches it later after you die. So you want kind of an expert, a pro, somebody that can get the best out of you once you sit down and start, you know, so it's not just you rambling. So I get it. You know, I wish maybe that we had seen a little more of what Stanford was doing for the operation, because we don't really see him ask any questions. It just seems like cut. But I like it as a seed of something that could have grown into a booming business. And also because it gives us those interstitials throughout the movie. Kind of like when you're watching When Harry Met Sally and they keep cutting back to interviews with couples and how they met.
One of them is the old guy from Seinfeld, who Kramer and Newman take the records from his apartment, try to sell them because Jerry's like doing community service, watching old people. I think he has like the most poignant message about life is fleeting but important.
Oh, he's not the one that goes, fuck women, fuck a lot of women.
That is not him, but that's an important message. Jimmy the Saint's business isn't doing too well, and his former boss, a local crime lord known as the Man with the Plan, that sounds just like that King of the Hill, this is Mr. Big, has bought up his debt in order to command a favor involving the crime lord's son, Bernard, who's been arrested for child molestation. This isn't like a theme in the movie, that of abuse on children, but it's how the movie begins. And when I say that, it's not terribly graphic. It's just kind of, goes to a park and grabs a little girl, and he gets stopped before anything bad can really happen. Excuse me. But having not seen this movie and having zero knowledge of it, when it opened with that, I was like, oh no, where are we going here, Ben?
In case you're just new to the Contrarians feed, Ben also gave us Pre-Persuasion not too long ago. And that's another movie that was made us squirm a lot.
Rocky to traverse.
Yeah. But no, here it's not that it's treated as a punchline, but it's definitely more of an anecdote. It's like you said, I mean, it's not about, oh, how are we going to stop this pedophile? But more like that's one of the things that sets the rest of the movie off. This guy, he doesn't even have the actor playing the Bernard, he doesn't even have a picture on his IMDb page. Do you think that this movie was it? Like,
it doesn't have a Wikipedia page either. Michael Nicolosi.
He was like, man, Fletcher did me dirty on that one.
His father, the man with the plan, is, you guessed it, Christopher Walken. And he is a quadriplegic. He was left that way after an attempt on his life. And the favor he calls in is he wants Jimmy to persuade Bernard's ex-girlfriend Meg to come back to him. The man with the plan believes this will cure Bernard of his pedophilia. Not terribly certain that's how it works, but Christopher Walken is a bit of a madman in this. So, you know, who's to say? You know, he probably feels just in his own mind. Christopher Walken, quadriplegic, guiding his wheelchair, you know, with a straw. Like, it's a bit startling at first. And his nurse is Jenny McCarthy, known public idiot Jenny McCarthy. she only has a few lines in this, but I did go, ha, when she showed up. But yeah, it walking, not doing much of it in this movie.
I was about to say, he's not walking. He is dropping slurs left and right, though.
He is extremely problematic in this movie. Hilariously, though, we get a flashback to simpler times with his son just so we can see Christopher Walken dancing.
I was more concerned with Andy Garcia also dropping slurs, but I guess that the point is that he's part of this world. He might have tried to distance himself from it, but in the end, starting with the language and all the way through his actions and the things that he's involved with, I mean, I guess you can take the boy out of the gangster life, but you can't take the gangster life out of the boy. So, I mean, it's also the 90s, right? Like, this is a Miramax 90s movie. So if you're sensitive to this type of language, then this is not the movie for you, because it never stops. In fact, it gets worse, I think. I think because Christopher Walken, right now in this introductory scene, it's nice Christopher Walken. He gets meaner and nastier as the movie goes on, and everything gets a lot worse, his language and his actions. So it was tough. But, you know, if you're going to have a character like that, then you might as well have Walken playing him. And Denzel was fine as a quadriplegic in The Bone Collector. But if I'm going to go with one character that can only move his head, then I would go with Walken in this movie.
There is an incredible moment late in this movie that comes from the premise of him being a quadriplegic that will get to when it comes.
So many to choose from.
A reluctant Jimmy recruits his friends Easy Wind, Pieces, Big Bear Franchise, and the rage-prone Critical Bill. Now, let's run down the parts here. Easy Wind, Bill Nunn. Pieces, the one and only Doc Brown himself, Christopher Lloyd. Big Bear Franchise, William Forsythe, who I'm a big fan of. Known Devil's Rejects advocate over here, and he's a big part of the reason why. And Critical Bill, who else but Treat Williams, who has far surpassing problematic dialogue to Christopher Walken in this movie.
See, I don't know, man. I think it's a battle of the non-PC between those two.
Well, I guess it's just the unpleasantness of Treat Williams's dialogue. There's a scene that goes on way longer than it should where he discusses eating feces. That's
His Oscar clip, you mean?
I didn't have him down for supporting in this, but I guess if I did, that would have to be it.
Neither did the Academy, if I recall correctly. Always a treat to see Treat Williams. RIP. Alex, this might be the most RIPs we've had in a movie. Bill Nunn, RIP. Jack Warden, RIP, right? Jack Warden as the Greek Chorus. So he's not part of the gang, but he's always pontificating and explaining.
It took me to the third time to realize that he's the conscience of the movie. I'm like, but the second time I'm like, okay, why are we cutting back to Jack Warden? And then the third time when he explains boat drinks, I'm like, oh, he's like the exposition of this comes back around to him.
How awesome would it have been if the final twist at the end is that he's Andy Garcia? You know, he grew to be old. Now he's just telling the story of his friends.
But in the days, there never was a better wingman when things got dangerous. Boys got equal parts piss, pesticide, and pure petroleum jelly running through those veins.
Jug Warden, obviously a very versatile actor, and here he's that center, the calming center. You know, no matter how chaotic the movie can get, we can always go back to this little malt shop and he's
just
there.
His tone never goes up or down. He's just consistent is the right word. He's the calming presence that resets us throughout the movie numerous times.
Yeah, horrible things happening around him, and he just kind of seems amused by it, a little concerned sometimes, like, Jimmy, are you okay? But that's it. When the movie's over, he's still there. I think he will always be there. That's the idea.
It's like Santa Claus.
Man, he could play Santa Claus.
The plan is to have Pieces and Critical Bill pose as police officers intercepting Meg's current boyfriend. Julio, who plays her current boyfriend?
Contreras' favorite, Josh Charles, coming back after Four Brothers, which was not too long ago.
And of course, of Wet Hot American Summer fame. He's uncredited in this, surprisingly, despite having a big part of a big city back-talking liberal.
Yeah. He's got a big scene, Alex, an early contender for the Embry.
I think he's kind of outshined by a few other contenders in this. He plays Bruce. And the idea is they're going to intimidate him until he agrees to break up with Meg. Things go awry when Bruce grows suspicious of the two men's identities and mocks them, whereupon Critical Bill stabs Bruce in the throat. Now, this everything he says is accurate. The highway like that, that's the state police, not, you know, city cops. Everything he says is right. You know, their uniforms don't fit accurately. They have no rain protection on. And they know their goose is cooked immediately. And Christopher Lloyd's just like, Marty, we got to get out of here.
Great Scott. He beat us.
The whole thing is they tell Critical Bill not to speak because he has such a short fuse. And of course, he gets mad and blows it, stabs the dude in the neck. And then I yelled out loud because this was so surprising.
Yep.
The commotion wakes up Meg, who was sleeping in the back of the van. Meg, her appearance startles Pieces, who accidentally shoots her in the head. It's happened so fast.
Christopher Lloyd.
Doc Brown.
First degree murder. I agree. That was a big surprise. I think you probably had the same idea that I did, which is that, oh, Josh Charles is not making it out of this alive. Right?
Like, no. Yeah.
We've seen enough movies that we know that the plan is going to go bad and the problem is going to kill the guy that they were supposed to scare away. I did not expect them to kill the guy and then kill the girl that was supposed to go back to Christopher Walken's son. So that was exciting. I was like, all right, well, all bets are off. Just like Travolta shooting Marvin in the head. Christopher Lloyd shot Meg in the head.
Oh, fuck. I shot Meg in the head. And could have used him freaking out about it. They do a good job of displaying they immediately know what this means. And so their like exasperation and hopelessness is the word I was looking for there is very well conveyed here. The man with the plan is furious at the outcome of their botched mission. He informs Jimmy that he will allow him to live as long as he leaves Denver, but his crew have been sentenced to buckwheats to be assassinated in a gruesome and painful manner. All right. So here is where Jack Warden really, really comes into play. The word buckwheats is said no less than 40 times in the span of, you know, 6 minutes in this movie. And I was like, what the fuck does this mean? And I even have in my notes buckwheats. And then like it shows Walken bringing in the coach from Hamlet 2, whoever his like assigned hitman is. I don't know that dude's name, but he comes in and it's just buckwheats, buckwheats, buckwheats. And William Forsythe even goes buckwheats. And, you know, Andy Garcia nods his head. He's like, ah, fuck. But then
it's the scene inside of Malkovich's head and being John Malkovich.
it's exactly that. But Jack Warden explains that buckwheats is a very skilled hired assassin, comes in and kills people in extremely painful ways, even going as far as to explain the idea of someone getting shot through their butthole up through them and how painful that would be. And it's, I don't know if that really necessitates a lot of explanation. I think that you could
well,
pretty quickly.
Jack Warden is a very talented storyteller. He knows that you have to add color and detail just to really, really paint the picture. And it really recontextualizes the story of the Gold Watch. You know, speaking of Walken and Tarantino, just now when he says that he stuck the Gold Watch up his ass, and now here you have him ordering an assassin to shoot people up their asses. There's a connection there that I think needs to be called out.
Marshall Bell is the guy's name, and excuse me, so he's the dirty cop that works for Christopher Walken and also assists in the killings, but the assassin that is hired to come in to clean shop is of course the Buscemi's. Steve Buscemi comes in as what's his name, Julio?
Is it Mr. Moss?
It's Mr. Shh, because he's so silent. Where the fuck did you get Moss?
I don't know.
Where did I get Munson?
Stab in the dark. I was, the idea of Steve Buscemi just being plopped into the movie halfway through the story, it's it tickles me so much. It shows up with this. It's not just that it's Steve Buscemi, character actor Steve Buscemi, also on loan from the Tarantino trailer, but that he is action villain Steve Buscemi. Like, he's physically dangerous, right? It's not that... usually when you see Buscemi, even if he's going to be dangerous, it's on the psychological side. Yes. He's going to outthink you. You don't think of him kicking ass and taking names, which is what he does in this movie.
If we just want to stick specifically to the 90s, we can think of like Reservoir Dogs. He's an assassin, but he's a bit of an idiot, you know, and finds himself in trouble regularly in that movie. Billy Madison, he's just a psycho with a gun, which... In 1995, when that movie came out, the idea of that was kind of funny. 2024, not so much. And then Con Air, he's what you just explained, right? He's like really just fucked up in the head. He's like a psychological deviant.
Fargo.
Yes.
You know, he's just kind of like squirrely, but the real dangerous guy as far as actions is Peter Stormare. I think it's Peter Stormare, right? Like his partner in crime. So I don't, tell me, Alex, I mean, were you excited when he, is that a clothesline, what he does with the Texas people?
I'm proud of you. Yes, it is.
Okay. did you ever think that in your lifetime you were going to see Steve Buscemi do that?
Well, not only that, but it is, this movie's 30 years old, but it is still like the idea that he's the final boss called in and it's fucking Steve Buscemi. He's wearing a fedora and shit and he's not to be trifled with. You know, he takes out this gang of skinheads. That's the most interesting part about it, is the story that explains who he is, shows him also as a man of compassion and conviction, because these skinheads are beating up this black dude and he saves the black guy by wiping out all the skinheads. And then later, like in the movie, after he kills someone, he plays a game of, it was a dice he was playing on the street with people. Like, he's a man of convictions, like I said, but he just has a job to do. It's a character you don't expect Steve Buscemi to play. And especially because, like, such a unique voice, such unique diction, and they pretty much take his voice away in this. He has dialogue, but not much of it. And this, of course, coming off the heels of one of the greatest movies of the 90s, Airheads, in which he is fucking hilarious. And so, man, he was all over the place. They don't make him like they used to, movies or actors. I'll tell you that right now.
There's only one Buscemi.
That is true.
There's only one, specifically, only one Buscemi in the 90s.
Yes, sir. When Mr. Shish accepts your buckwheat's paper, time to kiss the day goodbye and get real cozy with the notion of eternity.
Before we move on, Alex, I love the vernacular in this movie. I think that I don't know if Scott Rosenberg was just making shit up and it just sounds very realistic, or if he went and researched with gangsters and in Colorado and came up with all these terms. Because it's not just, we have boat drinks, we have... Give it a name.
They love Give It a Name.
What does it mean, though?
I don't know.
Is it like multi-purpose? Is it like Forget About It in Donnie Brasco?
I'd say yes, but they also say Forget About It in this movie.
Yes. Citizen. They call each other Citizen whenever they go, they leave the life of crime and they go straight. Which, you know, at first I thought when Walken calls Andy Garcia Citizen, I thought like, oh, he got his naturalization papers. But then Fairuza Balk talks about becoming a citizen, and I think
Fairuza. Her name is so intense. I always feel the need to pronounce it just like fucking hardcore shit. I am Fairuza. Like, I just wish she would say that when she introduces herself.
Maybe she does, just not in this movie.
Well, I think that's a good segue, because we do need to speak of the women in this movie, because there are two very central female characters in this. Despite this movie, you could argue it could transpire without them, but they're there and it's important. Fauza is one of them. She plays Lucinda, who's a hooker with a heart of gold. And then the love interest in this is Dagny, played by Gabrielle Anwar, who I do not know from anything, Julio.
But now we'll never forget.
she has a very, very unique look. And I mean that in a complimentary way. She was prior to this in the Three Musketeers movie starring Kiefer Sutherland, Chris O'Donnell, and respected actor Oliver Platt.
Well, I'm glad she survived that. The movie's terrible.
Well, she made these two things back to back, so I don't know. And then something called Innocent Lives, The Grave, Nevada. Seems like it was unfortunately kind of like a downward spiral. Now, the reason she is important is because she's the love interest for Andy Garcia, and every scene they have together is so tonally different from everything else in the movie that you would think it becomes distracting. It kind of ties together in the end.
Yep.
But it kind of adds this sense of heart to the movie that it seems to not have elsewhere. Elsewhere, it's just kind of badass dudes rock type shit. This adds a touch of humanity to it.
Well, I think it's also representative of the duality of Andy Garcia's life, right? Like, that's the whole point is he used to be a gangster. He tried to break away from that life and start his own business with the messages from heaven. And now he's been dragged back in, but he still pretends to have a normal life. I mean, that's this girl, Dagny, she represents the life that he wants to have. And there are times in the movie where he actually directly verbalizes that. He's like, I wish I could just be here with you instead of having to go back to my life of crime. And so I like that she's there to show us the other side of him, right? Like where he's just so suave in this movie. I mean, I've always liked Andy Garcia, but I don't think that I've ever seen him have this much game. And I think a part of it is just that the chemistry that he has with this actress is really good. And look, since the comparisons to Tarantino are inevitable, I got to tell you, the sparks between Dagny and Jimmy are so much more believable than anything that transpired between the bride and Bill. That was my main complaint when we did that episode, right? I couldn't buy them as lovers. And here I completely buy that Andy Garcia will just walk up to this girl, feed her these lines, and she's going to have this verbal ping pong with him. And then on their first date, they're doing the deed. I bought it. And so you buy into that, then you buy the heartbreak at the end of the movie when he has to leave her behind.
And then with Lucinda, Fauza, there's clearly a backstory. We as the audience know that immediately. And he does have a soft spot for her, so much so that he sees her on the street, you know, trying to turn tricks. And she's got a black eye and he has her explain what happened to her. And he goes and finds the guy that did it and publicly humiliates him and also, you know, roughs him up considerably. So, you know, he's
a good guy.
So he's, you know, a lover, but he's got another little honey he's keeping an eye on, you know, classic gangster type shit. It's his Gumar, as they say on The Sopranos.
How do you feel before we move on from Dagny? How do you feel about the fact that she's dating a guy named Alex, but she keeps cheating on him with Andy Garcia?
It's what he deserves. He probably likes wrestling and shit. So it's the life. It's the grave he's dug for himself. Whoever they got to play that guy is that must have been a favor to somebody's dad, because that the few lines that guy has are not good.
Well, it could also be just that Andy Garcia dwarfs him in that scene.
It's a fair call.
Clash. All right. So there's basically two halves of the movie, right? The first half is the setup. This is the crime. This is the thing that we're trying to pull off. This is the team. This is how it's going to happen. And then it goes bad. And then the second half of the movie, I thought the second half of the movie was going to be, well, now if we want to stay alive, we have to go after Walken. But that's not what happens. Is that where you thought the movie was going to go?
No, because I thought they did a pretty good job of establishing how powerful he is and, you know, the militia he has for himself. I kind of expected the end there to be some sort of duel or, you know, some, for lack of a better term, shootout between Garcia and him. But I thought this was going to be just the process of Garcia trying to make everything right by the guys involved.
Yeah. I mean, the title made a lot of sense once the second half started rolling. And I was like, oh, so the thing that he has to do in Denver is try to settle his affairs and the affairs of his friends. And they're all dead in a way because Christopher Walken has said so. So I thought that was cool. It's not where I thought it was going to go. And then it's just, it's a really weird, but in a good way, I think, turn for the movie where it just becomes this story of Andy Garcia settling his affairs. It's just really, right? Like he closes his savings account and starts trying to give money to his friends so they can leave, and nobody takes him up on it.
Christopher Lloyd shows up in a suit and a fedora, and he's like, nah, I'm going to stay here and face what comes. William Forsythe and his family try to get out of town, though.
But he still doesn't take the money.
Yeah. And then Bill Nunn, he gets in like a limo, and it looks like he's going out of town, but he's tracked down fairly easily.
He goes hang out with Don Cheadle, and it doesn't end well. Christopher Lloyd. Maybe Treat Williams was too much for the Academy, but Christopher Lloyd could have gotten a supporting nomination with this scene. It's tremendous.
Oh, it's excellent. Yeah.
He gets like a hell of a monologue. He had me convinced that he had been in Goodfellas, and I just somehow I'd missed him. He's talking about the good times, the good days when they ruled the world and all the things he did. I think it's kind of a shame. Look, he's always going to be Doc Brown, and that's great for the world. That's great for him. I don't think that he's one of those actors that resents being associated forever with that iconic character. But then you see him in a movie like this with this performance and with that a scene like that one, and you're like, man, it's kind of a shame that we maybe pigeonholed him into the role of the wacky character, you know, that's kind of like Doc Brown, but he can hit these notes and hit them believably. It's almost every time they cut to Andy Garcia on the other side of that scene, it almost looks like Garcia is also in awe, and he just forgot that he's in the movie, and he's just watching Christopher Lloyd perform. It's pretty cool.
Maybe I could have been a better old man to my kids. Maybe I shouldn't have pulled as much time as I did. But shit, Jimmy. We did the things. Them days. I had a snap brim hat. You walk into a joint. Forget about it.
Yeah, it's certainly his Oscar clip for Best Supporting Actor. Just the turning down the money and explaining he's lived the life he wants, and, you know, comparing it to people being on their deathbeds and regretting not living life. And he lived. We did these things. And then
yep.
Boat drinks is what we learn. The way they say goodbye to each other is they say boat drinks. And this, again, Jack Warden explains, is prison talk for once you get out of a long stint. The idea of being on a boat, you know, together, free, sharing a Mai Tai. It's a beautiful thing. Jimmy's friends come to terms with their impending deaths as they are stalked by Mr. Shh, who never fails. Pieces accepts his fate with Mr. Shh providing a quick death. He's in the projection booth. You know, if that was a viable career path, that's probably where I would die. And he
says, the same way, yes. Shot to the heart.
And he just tells them, make it quick. Easy Win goes into hiding with a gang lord named Baby Sinister, who is played by Glenn Plummer, returning to the Contrarians from Showgirls, which also came out in 1995.
Oh, my God. I knew he looked familiar, but...
But then his boy, Rooster, is played by Don Cheadle, and then the bouncer, House, is played by Debo. It's like this, it was quite literally overwhelming to the senses, the reveal of these three together.
Once you recognized all of them, did you have this sense, this horrible sense of dread, because you knew that Steve Buscemi was going to kill all of them?
Yes, but it resulted in two great lines of dialogue in which he says, I'm looking for Earl Denton, a.k.a. Easy Wind. And then Glenn Plummer goes, a.k.a. my dick. And then Don Gio goes, yeah, a.k.a. his dick. And when... Plummer faces off with Buscemi. Don Cheadle's just talking shit in the background, and he asks him, can't you shut up for 11 seconds? And I'm like, why is he so specific? Why does he need 11 seconds to do it? But yes, I knew the fate was coming. And again, Easy Wind. He's given up to Mr. Shh after he infiltrates and kills most of Glenn Plummer's entourage. Because Franchise has a family to raise, Jimmy pleads with the man with the plan to spare his life. The man with the plan agrees to Jimmy's terms, but betrays him anyway, having Franchise killed. The betrayal makes Jimmy vengeful. In turn, Jimmy is also sentenced to die.
Before we close the book on Christopher Lloyd, how many refunds, how many rain checks do you think they passed out on that showing when he died? Because he fucks up the projector when he falls back and it burns the print.
Burns up the print, yeah. I don't know. That man, imagine processing refunds in a porno theater. It's got to be a unique process, to say the least. This scene also where Jimmy begs for mercy from the man with the plan is done in a sauna. Christopher Walken's being tended to by Jenny McCarthy in the sauna, and Andy Garcia is just there in his fucking suit, sweating his balls off.
Either Donna's dad or the other guy says, like, oh, we had some good times in here, Jimmy. Which, I want that prequel. The prequel with a young Andy Garcia and a young Donna's dad and the other guy are just having a good time at the sauna before life got really hard for them. I guess that was before Christopher Walken was shot and his ass was glued to the chair, as he says in this movie. So what do you think of Walken? This is, now he's gotten nasty. Now he's evil Walken. Did you buy for a second that he was going to spare William Forsythe's life?
No. He's so overwhelmingly a bad guy.
Yeah. I wanted to say, Jimmy, you need to smarten up. I was really hoping that it was all part of the plan, that there was going to be a reveal last minute where he was like, no, he had orchestrated all this to allow his friends a way to escape. But no, he really was going there.
He pretty much just pushes him into the way of oncoming traffic.
Yep. But that just means that he believed that Walken would have the same moral code that some of his people do, right? Like, even Treat Williams, who's the most unhinged of them all, of his crew.
He's like boarded himself into his apartment and is peeing into jugs. Quite unsettling.
But he does have some sort of loyalty towards the group, right? Like, he says at some point that the reason he went off on Josh Charles and ultimately killed him is because he was making fun of Christopher Lloyd. He's like, mm-hmm. We got to stick together, he says. We have to stick together. That's how we are going to survive. And then, of course, the moment that they split, then they start getting picked one by one. So I can understand how Andy Garcia would have a blind spot when it comes to how twisted and completely amoral or immoral Christopher Walken is. But still, a bummer to see it happen.
And to circle back to something I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, when Jimmy comes back and, you know, cuts his big promo and Christopher Walken says, well, I'm going to kill you now. The thing we see at the beginning of the scene is Jenny McCarthy asking, she's spoon feeding Christopher Walken and she asks him choo-choo or airplane. And he goes, airplane. Like, you know, he's deciding how he's going to be fed. And it's such an insane notion of like a scene, but it's Christopher Walken doing it. So it's fucking perfect.
Okay, well, now I'm breathing a sigh of relief that that's the moment that you were going to highlight.
Yes. No, everything else he says is like, get this fucker out of here. That moment is just, from a filmmaking perspective, hilarious because it's Christopher Walken being fed like a baby and, you know, he's telling Jenny McCarthy how to do it.
Yeah, I agree.
Pretty funny, too, because Andy Garcia says, you gave me your word. He goes, I'm a criminal. My word means dick. Like, so matter-of-factly, it's tremendous.
Yeah. It was time for Andy Garcia to finally lose his innocence and realize that he had been working with a really bad guy. Treat Williams. They're all gone except for Treat Williams. He's the only one that, I guess, was smart enough to just grab a whole bunch of guns and hunker down in this really shitty apartment. And like you said, he's peeing inside a milk jug. And he gets his Oscar speech that we referenced earlier, where he explains that he didn't just eat shit for free in prison, but he ate just a little bit of shit and it was for a nickel. I don't think he meant an actual nickel, right? Like, he probably, that's like jargon for something that's more valuable than a nickel.
I would imagine so, yes.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. And also inflation, you know, this was the 90s. Whatever the case. It comes down to Treat Williams versus Steve Buscemi, which is not something I ever thought I was going to see. And I was fist pumping because he got him. I mean, they got each other, but still, did you expect Treat Williams to prevail here?
That was another oh shit moment watching this movie when he just blasts away Buscemi with a shotgun. It was very, very surprising. Well done.
What did he say? Me Godzilla, you Japan?
Yeah, which shockingly is on the lower tier of very upsetting things that Treat Williams says in this movie.
he didn't even put on an offensive accent or anything. He just said it straight.
On the spectrum of racist comments, it's pretty mild.
But then he goes out anyway, because Buscemi, he had a little gun. That was enough.
Little two shooter, just boop, right through the heart. And Buscemi's just like, I win. we get to see Andy Garcia drink another milkshake, which he does about seven times in the movie. But yeah, as Julio just recounted, Mr. Shh finally locates Critical Bill, holed up in his apartment, but is ambushed by Bill. The two end up killing each other. In the wake of Mr. Shh's death, the contract on Jimmy falls to a trio of Mexican brothers. In his final hours, Jimmy says goodbye to a young woman he had fallen in love with, Dagny. Knowing that he will most likely be killed, Jimmy murders Bernard for all the misery he indirectly brought upon the group. So he kills Christopher Walken's son. No sympathy. That guy, you know, his crimes deserve to be punished. More insanely, yep, he also...
I was about to say, there's a big moment that the Wikipedia summary just skipped over.
He also impregnates Lucinda. This is Failure's a Bulk, in order to fulfill her wish of becoming a mother. There's a part in the movie where she just confesses to him that she wants to be a mother and that she's ovulating and that he would be a good dad. And then I guess because he knows he's going to die, he's just like, okay, sounds good. And then he fucking records like a video to his would-be child. Like it's fucking, you know, Jack Donaghy or Phil Dunphy. Like it's Phil's Osophy. That's what he tries to do here. In a pre-recorded afterlife advice video, Jimmy gives life advice to his unborn child.
Did you catch the time code? The message is a little over 8 minutes. That's all the wisdom Andy Garcia had to impart.
8 minutes of how to live life.
This was wild. See, this is why the comparisons to Tarantino irritate me, because I think that this movie swings bigger. It's a little crazier. Like Tarantino,
its pendulum certainly goes wider.
Yeah. Tarantino stays in his sandbox, and it's a very entertaining sandbox. And we get it, right? He's interested in paying homage to the movies that he loved. This movie's not doing that. This movie's taking that kind of like as a starting point, and then it's just like, okay, what can we do? How far can we push it? And does it go into the tasteless, off-color territory sometimes? Yes, it does. Does it go into plot developments that are just a little too out there? Yes, it does. But when you're watching it, you're just as entertained, if not more entertained, than when you're watching one of Tarantino's pastiches. So I appreciate it. Again, like a couple of moments that we already called out in the movie, I did not see this coming at all. He stops by the street where Feruza Bog does business, and he's like, get in the car. And, you know, in the back of my head, I'm like, are they about to have sex? Is he going to do the baby thing? And then he does. They have sex in the car. It's amazing. Oh my God,
he admitted.
And you know what? This is following a scene where he's completely off his rocker by now. He barges into the bar where Dagny is with Alex, who has proposed to her by now, right? And Andy Garcia has bought his own engagement ring, and he wants this guy to use that ring to propose to Dagny. It's insane.
My note says, what the fuck is going on?
But the reactions from everybody validate that take, right? Nobody's taking this seriously. Nobody can believe that this is happening. So the movie is not telling you that this is normal behavior. Instead, it's telling you, yep, he's struggling by grief. He knows he's going to die. He knows he has to say goodbye to this woman. And he obviously has lost the capacity to discern what's appropriate behavior and what isn't. So I got it. In his final speech, I mean, it's very heartfelt. He doesn't give her the details, but he does say, I am dying, which is not a lie in the end. So yeah, good for Garcia, good for Rosenberg, good for Flitter. They go down swinging.
During this voiceover, also, there's a sick shot that I cannot imagine how many times it took, where Andy Garcia pulls up alongside Bob Pinciotti, and
yes,
he's in the background. Pinciotti's in the foreground of the shot, and he frisbees the like cabbie hat that the son was wearing to him, and it almost like replicates the idea of like a 3D effect in a 2D movie. It's like a really good shot, and I. Again, I'm curious how many takes it took to get it right.
Great acting from Donna's dad there, because he catches the hat and then the realization that it settles in. Yeah, it's great. But that's not the end of the movie, Alex.
It's not. As the trio of killers catch up to Jimmy, he takes his death gracefully. The man with the plan is seen mourning his son's death. Jimmy and his friends are seen together having boat drinks in the afterlife. And then Blues Traveler takes us away in the credits.
It's the Titanic ending.
It is. They're all rocking some sick Hawaiian shirts, so I approve.
A good time seems to be afoot. They're fishing. I think that the last one, because you go one by one, and the final reveal is Christopher Lloyd fishing, and my heart swelled with happiness. Because, I mean, I was sad to see them all go, even Treat Williams, but Lloyd was the one that was sadder. Because he had such a good goodbye speech. Is that what takes us out, or is it Jack Warden breaking the fourth wall?
I'm sorry, yes. I was just so excited to get to Blues Traveler. But yes, Jack Warden takes us out explaining why they had the secret handshake they did, which was basically, you know, putting your hand to glass when you see someone in prison, and then explaining that Jimmy the Saint was the bitch's bastard is how he describes him. That's the last line of the movie.
Andy Garcia walks into the mall shop one last time. His spirit, his tale lives forever. It's a surprisingly upbeat ending, considering how many people died on the way there.
So that was Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Give it a name, Alex. Give it a score.
Well, we can do that as we move along to Real Talk. You ready to move along?
Let's do it. Boat drinks.
Yes.